Well, meeting the Health Committee to order. First of all, we have another very excited person at the table joining us today for first day at work. Sarah Nazeski, something like that, if I said it right. Would you just reintroduce yourself to the committee and tell them what your position will be here?
Sure, I am.
You need to bring the microphone down.
I'm Sarah Nazeski, Sarah Will Nazeski, and I'm a GOP researcher. Caucus Research for Health and Human Services.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Representative Pepin, you've taken a look at the minutes of our February 8th meeting. Would you be willing to move approval?
So moved.
Any discussion or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have three bills before us this morning. We'll begin, first of all, with Representative Knobloch's bill. I'll move that House File 563 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. I believe that's correct?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman and members, House File 563 provides that service cooperatives can offer their health insurance plans to the private sector, in addition to the school districts, cities, and counties that can currently obtain health insurance through them. Service cooperatives, formerly known as EXUs or Educational Cooperative Service Units, have a long history of doing bulk purchasing for school districts and other entities and saving them money. They currently have approximately 150,000 lives insured across this state, have 7 offices and approximately 300 employees. Their annual pooled premium volume is now in excess of $500 million per year, and they currently have over 700 public employee groups in various group health pools across the state. In the past few years, they've begun selling VIVA accounts, which are similar to health savings accounts. These plans have been very successful in providing another option to their members. This past year, the health care cost increases in these plans were in the single digits, significantly below that of many other plans, and also cost, in some cases, about 20% less than competing plans on the market. In this era of skyrocketing health care premiums, this bill provides one additional alternative for small businesses and other private sector concerns looking to help their employees. Many have bemoaned the lack of competition in Minnesota, particularly in rural Minnesota, where it's often practically a monopoly situation with only one provider. They've tried to figure out ways of attracting new competitors to this state. This bill would allow a new competitor who is already here to offer their products to the private sector, which desperately needs additional alternatives. I'm pleased to have as additional co-authors on this bill, Chairman Bradley, Representatives Abler, Wilkin, and Otremba, who are members of this committee, as well as Minority Leader Intenza. And I have with me today Mr. Paul Brinkman from Mount Iron up in northern Minnesota, who is representing the service cooperatives. I'd like him to make a statement as well. Members, I'd like to support your support for 563, and if I could have a page come forward, I've got some handouts for Mr. Brinkman to have handed out. Thank you.
President Knobloch, as that's being passed out and maybe before the testifier, just a quick question. In the bill itself, it does say that the cooperative and pool must comply with, and you specifically refer to a couple of sections of statutes.
Yeah.
And if you just could give us a rough idea, what are those kind of statutes? What are they referred to? 62L, 045, and 62H?
Mr. Chairman, members, they're basically state statutes regulating insurance and talking about how the Commerce Department has regulatory authority over the service cooperatives in this matter.
Thank you. Oh, please proceed. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chairman Bradley, members of the committee, my name is Paul Brinkman. I currently serve as Executive Director of the Northeast Service Cooperative based out of Mountain Iron. We're a regional entity that serves the northeast part of the state of Minnesota. As part of the handouts today, I'll just take 5 minutes of your time and then answer any questions you may have. First of all, special thanks to Representative Knobloch for his invitation to join him here today. Across the state of Minnesota, you'll see a map that we handed out to you this morning. I'm representing entities based out of Mountain Iron, Thief River Falls, Fergus Falls, St. Cloud, Marshall, North Mankato, and Rochester. Again, representing about 709 member entities and almost 400,000 students across the state of Minnesota. If you look at the Minnesota Service Cooperatives, when you look at this map and you look at the work we do, remember that we're providing state leverage, regional flexibility, and local support. We're close to the people we serve. We're established in legislation, Minnesota Statute 123A21, where it allows room for public-private partnerships to the extent allowed by law. We have a proven track record in serving Minnesotans and a proven track record in serving smaller local entities, the kind of entities that Representative Knobloch mentioned in his opening remarks. Furthermore, if you look at the Minnesota Service Cooperatives, we serve, as was mentioned already, just over 700 public employers, representing nearly 150,000 covered members. We're market competitive as a public sector entity with over 95% renewal satisfaction. Our regional service centers and staff are located across the state of Minnesota. My colleagues this morning asked me to mention that in addition to insurance pools, our services include meeting critical local needs in cooperative purchasing alliances, academic challenge programs, special education, staff training and development, health, safety, and environmental management, and information technology. Are we ready? We believe we are. We believe this type of proposal leverages existing infrastructure, services, and expertise. We believe it builds upon our own long-term relationships, particularly in greater Minnesota. We also believe, more importantly, that when you look at some of the critical needs facing the healthcare landscape in the state of Minnesota, the Service Cooperative's health insurance plan offerings are at the forefront of policy direction and best practices, including consumer-directed models with formalized wellness, prevention, and disease management components. The Minnesota Service Cooperatives, our associates and staff are prepared to serve in any expanded role offered by the state of Minnesota. Two final anecdotes to talk about how we're being recognized across the state of Minnesota. Another handout is off the website for the State Auditor's Office. It mentions that the City of Battle Lake and Lakes Country Service Cooperative, represented by my colleague Dwayne Balkin in the Detroit Lakes area, was recently cited as a top program in the state of Minnesota for collaboration, controlling costs, and membership involvement. And just to take it one step further in the spirit of Representative Knobloch's bill, we have a copy of an award we received from the National Association of Development Organizations. We think it's unique for a couple of reasons. First of all, this award was not submitted by us. One of our members placed our name in contention for this national award. It really focuses on information technology, where the Northeast Service Cooperative has a redundant, high-speed network of fiber, wireless, and last-mile solutions already in place, and we put a pilot project together in Orr, Minnesota, where the Service Cooperative works as an intermediary between the public network and service providers in selling their services to the open marketplace in underserved and unserved areas. It's a public-private partnership and something we're currently doing in the Service Cooperatives. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brinkman. I can't help but comment. I've had a chance to visit with the Southeast Service Cooperatives, and with, specifically Suzanne Riley, just recently. And I travel the circles of healthcare insurance, healthcare costs all over the place, and I would commend her, and I think it's part of what you all represent, as probably having a better handle, as good as anybody that I've seen, understanding the marketplace, understanding the driving forces, and really being creative in trying to help the clients that they serve. I appreciate it, and it's no wonder you get the kind of recognition you've shared with the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I see no questions from members? Well, Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me understand the pooling. Is the pooling, like for instance in health insurance, do you use all of the members of the co-op in the pool, or does each individual school or city or local government pool themselves, and then it becomes a collective pool but not a total pool?
Mr. Wakeman?
Representative O'Connor. Chairman Bradley. Pardon me?
O'Tremba.
My apologies, Madam Representative. Just to back up a bit, in legislation, membership in the service cooperatives is strictly voluntary. Mm-hmm. So a member entity only joins when they see value in joining our cooperative. Mm-hmm. For the pools, each region involved in selling pool services has set up two separate pools, one for school districts, one for cities, counties, and other governmental agencies. Those pool members participate under a joint powers arrangement in statute with the service cooperative, and that joint powers arrangement is adopted by their local board, and then they give us powers to operate on their behalf. Does that help?
Mr. Chair, somewhat. What I'm saying is that each service cooperative decides if, let's say, all the schools are in one pool, or each school is in an individual pool. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Brinkman.
I'm really trying to find out if it's a true pool of the cooperatives or if it's each entity is their own pool. I'm understanding that it's...
Mr. Brinkman? Madam Representative, Mr. Chairman, a couple of ways to look at answering this question. First of all, if you're a participant in our pool, you are fully insured at the local level. We absorb the risk at the regional level, so we're self-insured. It is a true pool, and under the joint powers arrangement, you've empowered us to operate that pool on your behalf, along with the other members.
Mr. Chair, and each service cooperative operates that way, or they choose how to operate that pool piece?
Mr. Brinkman? Madam Representative, Mr. Chairman, because of the oversight that we have in statute, under law, and in the regulatory environment, every service cooperative is currently operating under that same structure across the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I guess it's confusing because in our service cooperative, each school has their own pool. All the schools in the cooperative do not pool together. Each school has their own pool, which takes away some of the benefit of a more reasonable price in the pool. So that's why it sounded like your pool was all together, but I know that ours is not.
Ms. Brinkman?
Madam Representative, Mr. Chairman, may we talk with you after the meeting today, find out what school district you're talking about, make sure we answer your question fully. But I do want to go on the record and say that my understanding today is that the service cooperative pools across the state of Minnesota are structured in the fashion that I put in testimony here this morning.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Kremba.
I know of two schools that have actually dropped all of their insurance because it was an individual pool within a cooperative.
If you can follow up with that. Representative Houston?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And kind of, maybe another way to get, well, at least to clarify that kind of same issue for me, does each district or would each employer under this new plan, would they all pay the same rates or do they pay different rates depending on the number of lives they have and all that kind of, all those kind of variables?
Mr. Brinkman.
Mr. Representative, Mr. Chairman, under the current pool structure that we have with our school pool and our city, county, other governmental pool, you're fully insured at the local level, which means that you're also underwritten at the local level based on your local experience and group factors. Then that particular underwriting rate renewal that comes through on an annual basis to the pool is then further available for additional pool discounts and also interpreted through our master agreement of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, where those rates are controlled at approximately 2-4% under trend.
Okay, just to follow up. So basically, each individual school district or local government entity is paying based on their own kind of circumstances, but they get a somewhat of a benefit because they're part of this bigger pool. Is that kind of?
Mr. Brinkman?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, what that means then, if you're a very small school district like Willow River and you have three people with cancer, the family rate's going to be over $20,000 a year. Because that's what underwriting means. The underwriting means that it's based on what your experience is and what your potential that would involve age of the people, sex of the people, whether or not they've been sick, and whether or not they're likely to get sick. So they're not really pooled.
Mr. Brinkman, any comment to that?
Mr. Representative, Mr. Chairman, excellent point. However, in the service cooperative pools as structured, one of the benefits of the pools is that the high cases, if you will, the stop loss, is covered at the regional level. So those high cases for a small district like Willow River does have some impact on rates, but the pool is able to absorb some of that high case by reinsuring at the regional level.
As I understand, having reviewed, there is a fair amount of moderation that occurred because of that stop-loss kind of phenomenon. And as a matter of fact, I've also understood that the service cooperatives for their customers are sort of torn because a lot of school districts find an advantage to having some flexibility at local level, at their own policies, which if it were sort of a statewide, they would lose that flexibility. So this is, as I understand it, kind of trying to service the customer and get advantages both sides. That's at least what has been explained to me, Mr. Brinkman. Does that sound correct?
Mr. Chairman, it is. It's our view, and we can demonstrate that, and it's not a perfect model by any means, but it's a model that works well in the current marketplace because We are using the best of the local environment with the local flexibility you talked about, the regional environment with pooling and reinsurance, and the state environment with a master agreement with an insurance carrier that allows us to control cost trends over time.
Thank you.
One more question, just kind of on a separate issue. In some sense, these service providers will be competing with private insurance companies. Is there going to be parity in terms of the assessments and taxes that I mean, in the private market, are like MCHA assessments and those kind of things, is that going to be subject, are these pools that apply in the private market going to be subject to those?
Mr. Brinkman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keeson, yes, they are subject to the MCHA tax. They are a non-profit cooperative, however, so they're not subject to corporate income taxes.
Right.
But the health care taxes like MCHA, they're subject to.
Thank you. And that's what this 65, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Keeson, I think, as I mentioned before, at the local level, being a fully insured product, that's what draws them into the MCHA and other tax assessments.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any further testifiers on your behalf?
No, thanks.
Okay, I think we did have at least one person that was on my list, and then if there's others that wish to testify, Julie Brunner? Good morning, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Julie Brunner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm not here today to formally sound off against this particular bill, but to take the opportunity to talk to you about some of the areas where we think the bill isn't exactly clear, and then talk about some of the drivers of health care, if you will. This bill would allow service co-ops to sell a product that in theory will be more affordable for small employers. It's affordable because it could be exempt from some current state requirements and taxes. We believe it's not entirely clear, and particularly if the product would be self-insured, the extent of requirement for the ex-sus or the service co-ops to pay taxes that are currently required by both HMOs and insurance companies. The bill is, I think, the symptom of a larger problem, and that's rising health care costs. Instead of allowing the creation of a product for some groups that is exempted from state regulations, we think we should be looking at reforming the entire system so that all Minnesotans can benefit from these same cost savings. Health plans are seeing smaller employer groups trying to self-insure in an attempt to reduce their cost of health care coverage for their employees. When a small group self-insures, this also means they avoid state laws, regulations, and some health care taxes. This exacerbates the cost for groups remaining in the fully insured market. What we need to do is to look at the entire system and fix it for everybody. We need to create incentives to keep people in a big pool. You know the reasons for the rise in health care costs. This committee looks at it a lot. New drugs and new treatments, new improved medical devices, increased negotiated rates with providers, an aging population, and society's ever-increasing demand for more healthcare services without regard for its efficacy or additional healthcare value. I appreciate the author's desire to find opportunities for less expensive ways of purchasing healthcare coverage. The rising issue of healthcare is a problem we're all facing as individuals, employers, and government purchasers. Efforts to reduce the cost of regulations and mandates have been a high priority for the health plans for years. We believe we should focus on pursuing collaborative and creative solutions to make the marketplace more affordable for everyone. We think that this approach misses that opportunity. The health plans in Minnesota are not opposed to new competition. They actually welcome the competition. But if the legislature decides to change the law to permit service co-ops or any other entity to sell health care coverage, we would ask that the law treat all entities equally and fairly. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Ms. Brunner, I have a great opportunity for you. The bill that would level the playing field by getting rid of the MSHA assessment, the taxes you're talking about. So we could fix that problem by passing that bill, and it's very soon to be actually jacketed. So that might be one way to solve the concerns that you expressed. Any questions, members? So, you know,
Well, I just make one quick statement, if I could, Mr. Chairman. I'd agree with much of what Ms. Bruner said in terms of the components of rising health care costs and some of the things that are caused for rising health care insurance premiums, but one was left out, and that was lack of competition. We have very few health care providers in this state in the insurance market, and in much of greater Minnesota, we are in a monopoly situation. And this would provide a significant competitor in many parts of the state that is not existing right now for the private market. So I think that's one good reason for passing this bill.
Thank you. Any question, members? Now, is there anyone else that we should... Thank you, Ms. Bruner. Representative Okemba, do you have a question to the testifier? I'm sorry, Ms. Bruner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, then, do you pay all of the same taxes as the other insurance companies, not just MSHA, but the other tax insurance taxes?
So is that a question to Representative Nadlock?
Whoever...
Representative Nadlock, you mean... I'm sorry, just to clarify, you're talking about with his bill... And I guess it would be a question from Knobloch.
Yeah.
Chairman Bradley, Representative Trump. But my understanding is that the health care taxes, for example, MCHA, yes, are paid by the service cooperatives the same as other health care entities. But these are nonprofit cooperatives, and so they are not paying taxes such as the corporate income tax that a for-profit sort of concern would otherwise pay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry. I was mistaken. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this bill? See no one, I'll renew my motion that House File 552 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Don't understand the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you,
Chairman and members.
President Sanderson, I believe yours may be fairly quick, so why don't we go ahead with yours then? Do we have it? Representative Sanderson would move that House File 675 be recommended to pass and be referred to the House floor, and we may discover a committee, and I will ask your opinions on this, that it be referred to the consent calendar. I think it may fit that, but we'll ask the opinion of the committee when we get to that point. Representative Sanderson, I understand that there are some things in what you're doing that could be affected by federal action, and we want to be sure that we don't have people writing quality reports that we've done this too many times. Well, we have a state version and a federal version, and I think you have in mind maybe an amendment to help us with that. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And the amendment, do you want to move the amendment now to get it in the shape that you'd like to present?
Yes, I'd like to move Amendment A2. And basically this is just further cleanup of the existing statute.
Representative Samuelson moves Amendment H0675A2. Representative Samuelson, I'm sorry, again, to explain what the amendment does.
Basically, the amendment just does some further cleanup of the statute. And that's basically what the bill, in essence, is about.
Well, Representative Samuelson, I think there's a fairly key part in your amendment on lines 22 and particularly 24. That changes the date also?
Yes.
Okay.
That changes the date to right. 2007 instead of 2006.
Any questions from the members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails by 1-0.
Okay. Okay.
President Sanderson, to your amended bill.
Okay. House File 675 was brought to you by the Minnesota Hospice Association. Commissioner Goodnow carried a bill 3 years ago that established a separate licensing statute for hospice providers. Until then, they were licensed under the home care statute. As the bill went through rulemaking at the department, It was implemented by the local providers, and a few errors were identified. This bill cleans up the statute so that it is easier for consumers to understand, and that's consistent with the Medicare requirements, as well as other changes adopted by the legislature. Mary Gilbert, representing Healthy Hospice, will walk through the various changes, and then Michelle Federley, who is the new executive director of the Hospice Association, is available for questions, as well as Lisa Edlick-Swenson, and she is the provider of hospice services, and I probably massacred her middle name in the hospice part. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Ms. Gilbert.
Welcome to the committee. Please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Mary Gilbert, representing Health East. The first section of the bill primarily is cleanup language. In some cases, we forgot to insert all of the providers, including Medicare. We missed some of the home care references that were in there. On page 2, clause 8, we adopted the language that Representative Bradley included last year as far as providing good faith estimates. We made that language consistent to what's in the rest of law when a person requests information about what a service will cost. We also made a minor change in on page 3 on when the termination of notice of hospice services. Sometimes a person actually becomes ineligible for hospice services. It might be a person with MS and they come out of the remission and say they are no longer eligible for hospice services. So this just clarifies that you can terminate hospice services if the physician determines that the patient is no longer eligible for it. The other sections are just reordered, so they're a little easier for the consumer to read. The next section of the bill relates to a voluntary effort that's going on right now by hospice members to gain some quality data. This requires, as a condition of licensing, that a hospice provider will submit some data, and you can do this electronically, to the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. Right now, it's the only national organization that's actually collecting quality data, and that allows the hospice provider to look at other similar hospice providers around the nation and compare themselves. The amendment that Representative Samuelson offered does delay the effective date, and the issue that the chairman raised relates to if CMS does adopt a different, the reason the concern about it was that CMS right now is considering adopting these standards, and if CMS should decide at some point in the future to adopt a different standard, we understand that it's not in your interest or our interest to be reporting on two different data sets, which is part of the reason we come with the delayed effective date. And the final section deals with Hennepin County Coroner's Office. It just creates an exception that's more consistent with the standard of care for hospice and more consistent with the standard of care around the rest of the state. When a person is in hospice, generally the person visiting in the home is a nurse or a nurse practitioner and not a physician. And the nurse then reports back to a physician. So this just makes an exception for doing an investigation for a coroner from to 180 days, again, which is consistent with what the rest of the state is doing.
And, Mr. Chair, that's the review of the bill.
Mr. Thiessen?
Thank you. Just a quick question on page 2, where you're talking about no in advance of receiving care. I'm on lines 8 and 9. Receiving care, whether the hospice services are covered by insurance, and you're changing it to may be covered by insurance or other providers. Can you explain why that change is being made?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen. Often when a person is in hospice care, they're having lots of different kinds of services provided. For instance, the hospice service is generally done on a per diem basis, so it's really easy to talk about what services are included in that per diem and what the daily payment rate is. A family may choose to bring in a private duty nurse or some other kind of physical therapist or respiratory therapist that they arrange for, but we don't often know what the exact, you know, they would have to deal with that piece of their insurance for that service.
Thank you.
Thank you. No further questions, if you'd like to proceed with those testifiers, I unless you're just staying, I've been instructed by people in sales that when you got a sale made, you might want to be careful.
Continue. Mr. Chairman, I'm just available for questions.
Okay. Well, I see no further questions. Let me ask the pleasure of the committee. I think this would be a candidate for consent calendar. Any objection to consent calendar move? All right. I'll modify. Representative Sanderson will modify her motion then. And move that House File 675 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the consent calendar. In discussion.
That's correct.
Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Don't confuse me. Yeah, go ahead.
Are you here? 30 to 35.
As Representative Bradley goes to the table here, I want to welcome all the smiling guests in the crowd here today to the committee. And we all patiently await and look forward to Representative Bradley's presentation of his bill. So with that, Representative Bradley, Chairman Bradley, welcome to your committee. And if you could, do you have a motion, Representative Bradley?
Mr. Chair, I do. My first motion would be to call it our committee. How about that?
That sounds good.
I would move House File 619 for consideration in the Health Finance Committee bill.
Representative Bradley moves House File 619 be considered for the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Representative Bradley, if you'd proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do want to give a little bit of quick background because I know there's been a lot said, sometimes even in the media, about the whole issue of parental fees. And I want to bring people for a moment back to the 2003 session in which the governor had made recommendations on raising parental fees. We were in conference committee. Senator Berglund made a very strong point in one of the debates about that we have a situation in which families who have considerable means are accessing medical assistance. And she was referring specifically to the TEFRA program, which there are 20 states that have this allowance, or 30 states that have no allowance for any access to TEFRA. And what that does, in an important way, is allows families who have disabled children to be able to access medical assistance. The only caveat on that access is to pay some parental fee. And I think Senator Berglund and I agreed on, because frankly our situation at that time is we had families of four who were making nearly $60,000, who were paying $25 a month and accessing thousands of dollars per month of medical assistance benefits. Those are taxpayer benefits. And I think any reasonable person looking at that would say that that really was not a very good balance, that there could be more personal responsibility on the part of those families. And frankly, when I talk to most families, they would agree at those kind of levels. The Senate had a proposition that was even a much bigger increase. We ended up concluding in the moments of that conference committee to go essentially with the governor's proposal. And that's what went into law. Now, subsequent to that, of course, I mean, when you actually see it in practice sometimes, you see some things sometimes that are different than what you expect because of details. And I know that, I mean, engineers can't resist putting things into charts, okay? So if you'll bear with me, I hope that in members' packet there's kind of a hand-drawn thing like this. This is what I think is particularly exacerbating about the current situation as we passed it in 2003. There's two, I think, major problems with that. One problem is a phenomenon that I hate in anything that we do when we establish any kind of fee levels, and that is what's called cliffs. Cliffs are where you're at a income level, and with $1 more, you suddenly jump to a significantly higher level of copayment. And if you look at the chart, you'll see that at 675% of poverty is what that line shows in the current line. You see a significant jump from about 7.5% of their income to 10%. And that happens again at the level of about 975% of poverty. So that's one problem. The second problem, which was a little more subtle, is when you look at the range of income between
about, I think it's 175% of poverty, and what was at that time around 300 or so percent of poverty, you had an extremely steep line where the percentage which went from 1% of their income to 7.5% of their income moved very quickly. And so it meant that families whose income were moving just a slight amount saw relatively significant changes in their family copays. And these were, if you saw some of the more compelling cases, to me anyway, they were typically people in sort of this middle income level. So those are the two problems that House File 619 tries to deal with. And the bold line sure shows the way in which I'm proposing to do that. The first item, and we don't change anything at the 0 to 100% of level, there's no co-payment required. From 100% of federal poverty level to 175% of poverty level, the family co-pay is a fixed amount of $4. I might question whether $4 is enough, but I'm not changing that at all. What I'm changing is the slope of the line, and that means from 175% of poverty to, I think, about 575% or 550% somewhere, we're changing that from 1 to 7.5%, which you can see creates a space between the current and the House File 619. That's a space that is a reduction in families' co-pays. And then also you see, rather than having that cliff effect at 675%, we smooth that out by having a band that goes from 7.5% to 10% in the range of 675% of poverty to, I think, about 900 or 975% of poverty. Those are the changes, members, that are done in House File 617. Let me also refer you to another handout that should be in your folder that gives you at least a few data points so that you can kind of put this in specific numbers. It's the sheet that says House File 619 parental fees on it. It has a chart at the top that shows income and fee, which shows current, and then what the proposal would be. The more interesting, probably for specifics, is at the bottom of that chart are various spots. Do you not have that, members?
No.
We're checking into it real quick here, Representative Bradley. If we were to have it, what would it look like?
I'll try to give you a verbal picture.
Paint the picture.
Yeah, I will do that as best I can. I apologize, members. Keep in mind that Cheryl Burke, who's usually on top of all these things for us, has been ill for the last couple of days, and that's part of the reason probably for this, and I apologize for that. Let me just give you a couple of data points that I think are helpful that you may have heard from. In the range of a family of four, making $50,000, for example, prior to the changes made in 2003, their family co-pay was at this $25. Remember I used the example of families approaching $60,000 even? Well, there's an example where somebody was paying only $25 and could easily have been accessing thousands of dollars worth of benefits. When we passed the bill, and current law would have that family paying $140. And you've seen the math that's been done by some people saying my percentage of increase was 800%, those kinds of things. Well, from 25 to 140 is upwards of, I think, 600% or something like that, close to. That may not be altogether too bad a level, but what this curve does in changing it is that would now be $94. So specifically, a $50,000 family, current law would be $140. The change in House File 619 would lower that to $94. To give you another data point, at $60,000, in current law they would be paying $250. The new under House File 619 would be $175. At $75,000 family of four income, current law would be $454. They would be paying under House File 619 $284. And that's kind of the indication. So you have sort of a specific feel for individual numbers, and you have, I think, the chart sort of shows you graphically the actual effect. Let me sort of bring this to conclusion with, I'm still reeling a little bit from the shock, members, so bear with me, but I did get handed a preliminary fiscal note, and if I remember right, last year, We had an estimate of about $500,000 a year on this proposal, so about $1 million for the biennium. The good news that I have, that's hardly good news, but I have a fiscal note in front of me that costs to $2.6 million. I have not had a chance to react to it. That places this whole proposal with some difficulties. I have no intention, however, of dropping this. I think this is a very important issue. But I just want to be honest with the committee that we do have, and it was just presented to this morning. I've not had a chance to go back and discover sort of what's driving that, why this huge change from where we were previously. Ms. Shirley, are you going to make some comment to that?
Ms. Johnson,
you want me to be mad at you, do you?
Just
a messenger.
Just some quick analysis that I have, and I don't have all materials in front of me. The 04 session talked about making a modification between 175 and 4, 85% poverty, so that first incline would be a little different than what you see it on the sheet here. 619 goes 175 to 545% of poverty. So if you could just bear with me, I could get perhaps more information, but that to me would have a cost implication.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that would be a surprise to me, because it was supposed to have been written exactly as it was written for 2004. Here's would be my commitment to the committee. I am committed absolutely to try to provide relief. We're going to have to do it in some sort of an affordable range, and if we have to change the curves a little bit in order to bring into a range that I think I can justify to the committee, we'll do that. All we're going to do today is lay this over for possible consideration, and I'm committed to continue to work on it. So I'd be happy to answer questions on that, but that's probably as far as we can go on the numbers.
Ms. Samir, do you have some clarifications with this?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that the language in House File 619 should be identical to what was in the Health and Human Services arm of this bill last year.
Thank you. That's what I thought.
All right. Okay. Representative Bradley, are you done with your portion of the testimony?
I am. I know there's some people that would like to speak to us.
All right. We'll now call on Steve Larson, the Executive Director of ARC Minnesota, to come forward. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Larson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Finstead and representatives, I'm Steve Larson, and I'm the Executive Director of the ARC of Minnesota. And I'm very pleased to be here today discussing this bill. In the past few months, the ARC of Minnesota has conducted 16 town meetings with legislators across the state to discuss parental fees. And many of you were able to attend those meetings both this year and last year, and I thank you for taking the time from your busy schedules to do that. At those town meetings, we heard how the increase in parental fees has had a tremendous impact on families. Many of those families are here today, as Chairman Finstead had acknowledged earlier. And I want to thank the parents and children who have made a great effort to attend today's hearing. We are very pleased that this early in the session we have the parental fees bill in both the House and Senate. And I, too, am suffering a little bit from sticker shock from the fiscal note, and we'll obviously have lots of discussions about this bill throughout the session. But we are grateful that this bill is being heard so early in the session and that this committee is addressing it as well as the Senate. The ARC of Minnesota supports all efforts to bring relief to these families, and we intend to work hard throughout the session to come up with the best possible solution for these families. I'm going to keep my testimony very brief so that we can hear from a couple of families. And the first person I'd like to introduce is Jessica Wilson, who's here with her son, Lars, and they came in from St. Cloud this morning. Jessica?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Jessica Wilson, and I would like to address the chair and the representative to hear my testimony for today. I'm married with two children. I have a daughter who will be three, and then this little guy who just turned one. He was born with spina bifida. Before Lars was born, I worked full-time as an office assistant and insurance agent's office. My husband runs a machine shop. My daughter went to daycare, just like every other child does in today's society. And when Lars was born, I immediately enrolled him in the supplemental PEPRA program just to help cover the expenses that would not be covered under our primary insurance plan.
I reduced my hours down to part-time employment for the reason of caring for my son and his needs, because he does have extra cares that need to be done daily. And in June, I had to leave my position for the sole reason of taking care of my son and the parental fees. Lars has had to go Lars has had to have 6 surgeries, countless hospital stays, and it doesn't include the 25-plus CTs and x-ray scans that he has had to incur over the last year. Since November 15, 2003 to November 15, 2004, my son has been out of the hospital 4 months non-consecutively. In September, our insurance switched to Medica. Our deductibles start over. The copays start over. Hello, bills. So our out-of-pocket expenses went to $500 individual in-network and $5,000 family in-network deductible. I had to, at that point, when we were looking at the deductible cost, the parental fee cost, I had to quit my job. My income monthly covered 75% of our parental fee. And that did not even include the regular expenses of child care, health insurance, which we carry through my husband's employment, and so on and so forth. Before we knew it, our savings was gone. We dig deep to cover his medical costs every month. The parental fee premiums for 2003 were $157. We could afford that, not a problem. We weren't complaining. We want to do our share. 2004, they went up to 409. Well, we need the coverage because of his medical condition. We kept paying it. 2005, it would have went up to $500 plus a month. This is for a supplemental insurance plan. At the time, we discontinued the premiums as of June 30th because we could not afford them. This has placed us in a financial hardship. We have to second-guess ourselves to even bring Lars down to the hospital for a CT scan if his shunt is failing. If the program fees continue to increase or the program is not available for parents, I don't know how parents and such as myself are going to be able to afford the rising health costs. We do the best we can, and the supplemental insurance allows us the opportunity to provide a PCA and other care for our son that he will need along the way. The medicines he frequently takes are $10 to $25 per prescription. He's on anywhere from 3 to 4 prescriptions a month, and some of them only last a week. And so with having to refill a prescription every week, costing $25, you can see how the costs add up very quickly. At this time, with not being enrolled in the TEPR program, we have been locked out of any services. We need the parental fee program to be accessible and affordable for all who need and depend on them. And I'd like to thank you for listening and allowing myself to share a little bit of our family story with you today. And I will take any questions if anybody has any.
Ms. Wilson, thanks for being here today and for sharing your story. And if you could please bring him back later in the session. I looked around and everyone was smiling. So
he's very sociable.
Yeah, he's a cute little bugger. So bring him back. We need smiles on this committee. So thank you for being here. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Wilson? All right. Thank you, Ms. Wilson. We'll call on Brad Trahan. If I got that name right, if you could please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much. My name is Brad Tran from Rochester, Minnesota. Parental fees is an emotional issue. My wife and I were introduced to parental fees back on January 23rd of 2003, and we received news that a lot of Minnesotans' family face that we have a son that's got severe autism. All the hopes and dreams that you dream of your child come crashing down on you. And we learned later that the support out there was very little. And so we found the RT Autism Awareness Foundation in Rochester. When it comes to parental fees, It's a situation that my wife and I are both working full-time, and we just had to pay. Our monthly parental fee is just under $600 a month. Yeah, my wife could work extra shifts. So I could go find another job. But it's only based on this current system, it's only going to raise our parental fee. This is a situation where I do also recognize that this is a trickle-down effect for the state of Minnesota. Until the private insurance industry starts to get it and help our children to give them the therapy and services they need, it does come down on you guys. This issue is really not about politics. It's about giving our children a chance. It's about doing what's right for our kids. There's families face emotional battles. We go through emotional battles every day with our son. But we take a deep breath, we say, what's next? In a situation where these families continuously, and I should note that although we've been introduced by this situation with autism, I am speaking on behalf of any child that goes through a disability in their family. Each disability is equally important. As a whole, what I'm asking from you guys as public politicians, and I appreciate your public service, is that we do need the maximum relief. We're going to drive families into bankruptcy. It's the old adage, if we don't pay now, we're going to be paying later. Many of us families face possibly putting our children in permanent living. That is not only a financial burden, it's also an emotional burden. One of the things that I face as a father is going to church each Sunday and seeing families around me and knowing that we have to take shifts to go to church due to recent disability. I took it for granted when I was growing up to be with my family at church. I don't take it for granted anymore. Not jealous. We don't ask for sympathy to feel sorry for. We only ask for empathy to understand. And if there's anything that you guys can do for all of us families, for all of our children, is to give us the maximum relief possible on these parental fees, and that would be a good solid start in 2005 to start getting things done. Thank you so much for your time, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tran, for coming up from Rochester, and thanks for your great testimony. Any questions, members? Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Bradley, when we're talking about the percentage of fees, is that off adjusted growth income, or what's that calculated from?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Powell, the expert shaking her head, yes, and I agree.
Oh, off
the adjusted gross income, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, we'll move down here. I have Mary Welty on my list. Is Mary here? Okay. Representative Bradley, we'll turn it back to you to wrap it up.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate ARC Minnesota giving us a couple of examples, and I know that we could probably have 50 families parading for us before us with similar situations. I come from a family where Bob, my developmentally disabled younger brother, lived with our household all the time. I know the kinds of situations that these families and all the other families behind them go through. There are huge sacrifices that are involved. I fully know that. By the way, I also know that there's huge love. I don't think there's families that have any more sort of appreciation for humanity and for genuineness and so forth than families that have this kind of challenge in their families. And I think every one of us knows families like that. And my heart goes out, my hat is tipped, and I have all the respect in the world for every one of these families and the kind of things. And Brad, he's an incredible advocate. He's done a marvelous job of bringing more awareness specifically to autism, but I think the whole issues. He's sponsored walks. I think he's sort of a model for the kinds of activism that people with these kind of situations have. And I appreciate that there's a partnership. I mean, and that's what the TEFRA is all about, is providing a partnership. It's a partnership which is, you know, I don't know that any of us have the right exact. I think the numbers, the House File 619 sort of prevents in its final result, are fairer numbers.
I can't say that it's still not difficult because every individual family situation is different. Frankly, it's sometimes I think it's kind of a strange design because it's an absolute amount. It has nothing to do with the amount of services that are accessed. For some families, accessing thousands of dollars of services, it is an incredibly good deal to get help from the taxpayer. For those that are receiving just a smaller amount, it may not be at all. I mean, of course, there's nobody's command that you have to do it. So it's sort of a bit of a strange design, but it's what we have. It's a good tool. And I do think it's important for us, whenever we do something around here, it's important for us to look back at it and see how it worked. And I hope the chart that I presented to you sort of shows that there were some flaws in its current design. I think that House File 619 tries to improve on those flaws. And by golly, I hope this committee, we as a team, will do all we can to help these people. I appreciate your support.
Representative Barry, thank you for leading the charge. Are there any questions from committee members or the author? Any questions? Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, just to kind of put, to get a little bit of understanding, I think the two testifiers said that they were going to be paying $600 a month and $500+ a month under the current law. Do we have any sense of where they would be with this change?
That's not badly.
That's too difficult.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, it's a little hard, but I didn't give you all the data points that I have. I do have a data point at $100,000 for a family of four. I mean, it gets complicated because the poverty level is adjusted for every family side. But if we use that as an example, under current law at $100,000, that's where about $600 per month is.
Mm-hmm.
And that would become $571.
Okay.
It doesn't change much. If we get up really high, this if you look at the chart, it doesn't change it a whole lot except for that little band.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Seeing no further questions, Representative Bradley will renew his motion that we lay over House File 619 for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Service Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Bradley.
Thank you. Well, now to change gears, and I would ask a little patience on the part of the committee. Anybody who has it really close to you or where you have somebody in your own family, it is a little emotional, so forgive me. Okay, we said we'd pick back up on the Department of Human Services, so we can call forth Commissioner Goodnow and proceed from where we were in the presentation of the Department of Human Services budget. Welcome back to the committee. And I think I also should remind members, and I don't mean if we need to spend the time, we will certainly do it. I know we're a little less than what I had hoped we'd be in time, but if we are unable to complete, we'll reconvene at 7 o'clock this evening. So, Commissioner Goodnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be back. Again, with me is Assistant Commissioner Osberg to continue to move through the areas within the healthcare operations section of our budget.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, direct you to page 30. Entitled Better Managed Healthcare Programs. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what we're asking for is some resources to, in essence, better manage our healthcare programs. We have a $3 billion a year budget. And we're in need of additional capabilities to manage those costs. There's three key priorities that we have in healthcare administration in terms of managing our services. One is program integrity. Number two is program management, healthcare management. And number three is program efficiency. If you look in on page 30, we need to build up our capability to detect and prosecute fraud and abuse, provider fraud and abuse. As the legislative officer's report a few years ago pointed out, we have the same number of staff people in our SIRS unit, the Surveillance Investigative Review unit, that we had 10 years ago. We're in need of additional staff people. We're also in need of additional tools to detect and to prosecute provider fraud and abuse. We also need the ability to coordinate our activities with other agencies, especially the Attorney General's office. So we're asking for resources here to improve our ability to detect, prevent, and prosecute provider fraud and abuse. The next item on our program integrity is on page 31, and this relates to complying with federal requirements relating to this issue. The federal government passed a program called the Payment Error Rate Measurement Program, and that program requires states to conduct greater audits around three areas. One is eligibility, client eligibility. The other is around payment accuracy, as to how well we pay, how accurate we pay providers and managed care organizations. And the third is around medical necessity review. These requirements are expected to go into place this year. And at this point, we're anticipating that we're going to need 10 FTEs to comply with these requirements. There'll be three FTEs in the medical necessity review area and seven in the area of eligibility review. On top of that, the federal government is also going to, we expect, to reinstate the requirement that we conduct what's called Medicaid eligibility quality control audits. This was waived back in 1997 because we put into place some other quality control provisions. However, the federal government has told us that they expect to require us to continue this process beginning probably this summer. What's unusual, though, is that this also focuses on eligibility review. So we have two requirements, and both of them are focusing on eligibility review, but different approaches to it, different sampling techniques, and it requires us to, in essence, do it two different ways. We're trying to convince CMS that we should combine these two efforts around eligibility reviews. So we're asking for, we have to have, based on our analysis, we have to have an additional seven people to comply with this requirement. Again, we hope to be successful in convincing CMS to combine the two efforts into one, and perhaps that will happen. But clearly, the federal government is putting more focus on program integrity and quality control, and it's very appropriate. We just hope that whatever they end up developing is something that's workable and adds value to our efforts. So these two requirements, in essence, require seven additional FTEs. The other item under program integrity is to continue our efforts to develop better quality control around the Minnesota CARE program. We're asking for three FTEs to build on our ability to detect and calculate error rates by counties and Minnesota CARE staff around eligibility determination for Minnesota CARE. This is part of our corrective action plan that we put in place in response to the legislative auditor's report of 2 years ago, if you recall, and that this is these are the resources we need to continue to implement that corrective action plan so that we have better eligibility determination rates for Minnesota CARE. And the other item on the bottom of page 31 is that we're asking for two additional FTEs for us to address the issue of our client fraud and abuse in terms of Minnesota CARE program. We today have one FTE involved in that area in terms of recovering monies that were not appropriately gained. So we're asking for two FTEs, additional FTEs, to build in our client fraud and abuse efforts in Minnesota CARE. This take into consideration the proposal that we discussed yesterday in terms of the reduction in Minnesota CARE eligibility. The next item under program integrity relates to ability to
Excuse me.
Can we take questions
within each section?
The clarification would be, it says you need to do 1,000 claims annually.
Yes.
And why do you need 10 people to do 1,000 claims?
Strasburg?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, it's very involved, very complicated process. It requires extensive review, and we can get into its specifics. Glad to have somebody address that as to all what is involved, but this is our best estimate as to what's going to take for us to conduct this audit.
I don't think we need to get into it now, but I think we do need that information. And the other question I would have when we get to that, I think that there are, that there are companies that do some of the similar stuff now, insurance companies, et cetera, and back room for insurance companies. Have we considered that piece of it in doing some of these things?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I'm not aware of any insurance companies that do these kind of audits. They do certainly have fraud units and detect, and there's organizations out there that contract with insurance companies that look at payment accuracy and things of that sort that help. So there's two efforts here. One is improving our payment accuracy, which we're examining those options and maybe bringing somebody in to help us do that. The other is actually detecting the accuracy. And that's all these positions are for, really, are to determine whether or not those payment levels and our medical necessity levels are accurate. And so it does not go to where we really need to be, frankly, and that is how can we make sure that we improve our payment accuracy and improve our medical necessity determination. That is, I think, the greater value, frankly, for us to focus on that, but that's not what the federal government is requiring us at this point.
Thank you.
I've asked Representative Emmer to sort of follow up. I think a 2003 Minnesota Care legislative audit that was done, and perhaps some of this ties to it. Representative Thiessen, if you're interested in this topic, maybe the two of you, I mean, as kind of representatives of the committee, could spend some time with the department. I don't understand you.
Representative
Emmer, are you something?
I'll look forward to it. I'm just happy you didn't ask for a report today.
Thank you, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if now is the time, but we're going through a whole bunch of items here that will total up to someplace around 40 FTEs. And if you look at the fiscal impact, there's actually savings, it looks like to me, so... I don't know if they want to explain that much money with all these things.
Yeah, it was going to be a question of mine, and maybe this is as good a time as any, because I think you're kind of getting toward the end. My assumption, having worked with some of these people, is that there is a return on investment. I mean, I'm sorry, I should let Mr. Osbeck, if you can answer that question in terms of the chart that we're seeing with the numbers, then, is the net after all of this.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There is a return on this investment, especially in the... provider fraud and abuse area. Not so much on what I just described in terms of the federal requirements. We don't see a good return on that investment necessarily because it does add to our process improvement activities. But on the fraud and abuse side of it, it does have a positive impact.
Thank you. You proceed. Well, I'm sorry. That's a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually don't have a problem with you adding the staff that you need because I know it can be cheaper than contracting this work out. So the other thing, but I wanted to ask, is the federal government giving us any money for any of these positions or these mandates that they're imposing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, first of all, thank you for your consistency. We don't always see that on these issues. Secondly, I believe there's an FFP match on these positions, so there is a federal match on it, although there's still state resources that are required to pay for our match on it.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair and Commissioners, maybe you don't have it today, but I'd be interested in each one of these items that we're going through, what the potential cost of each one of those is and the potential savings of each one of those.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, if you look at the yellow spreadsheet, the bright yellow.
Okay.
If you look at page 6 of that.
Okay.
It's broken down there by areas. So there are some of them that where we get a return on investment. There's a couple of them where we don't. And actually, we can know it. So for the ones that Assistant Commissioner Osberg has talked about so far, the fraud and abuse issue, there's a return on investment that actually increases going into the next biennium. Complying with the federal program integrity requirements, as you mentioned, is not necessarily a return on investment. And then the Minnesota Care Fraud, just glancing at the numbers, it looks like it might be almost an even or just a hair, it looks about even, or there's a slight return on investment. And then we'll make a note of that as we go through the rest of the explanation, is if it's a net savings or net cost.
Yeah, I think it might be good to refer to that so people see there is a backup detail, which I think pretty much answered your question. Thank you. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, on page 32, we are proposing that the state and the county are given the authority to bring legal action against a person who receives assets or income for less than adequate compensation from a medical assistance recipient, who that recipient remains eligible because of the divestment of the assets or income. The idea here is to deter transfer of assets that would, for less than fair market value, that would not be appropriate. What happens is that the last 10 days of a month, oftentimes what happens is that either assets or income is transferred in order to avoid what's called a penalty period, because there's a federal requirement that says that there has to be a 10-day notice for that transfer of asset or income. So, unfortunately, some people take advantage of that arrangement and reporting that transfer late in the month. Thus, the penalty period does not go into effect. So, we're asking for ability to recover, take legal action against the person who received that uncompensated asset.
You proceed.
The next item relates to the recovery of state assets in irrevocable trusts and annuities. 2 years ago, we put into law a ability for the state to recover assets into a joint tenancy or life estate. What we're proposing here is to expand that to include irrevocable trusts or annuities. Because the only reason that this would happen is because it's to avoid the law that was enacted 2 years ago. So we're expanding the definition of assets to include irrevocable. We make some exceptions here, but very few exceptions. So we're expanding the definition of assets that could be potentially recovered. And so it's just expansion, as I said, of the 2003 law.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a little bit of a lawyer question, but I talked to the Bar Association, their Probate and Trust Division, and they have some concerns about the impact of, I think it's this proposal is going to have on trust law generally and how things have been set up. Have you been talking to them and working with them to try to work through some of those issues? And if not, I guess it's more of a comment. I'd encourage you to do so, because they do have some concerns about the effect that this is going to have.
Commissioner Goodnow, is there a way that prepared you for this?
Yeah, Representative Thiessen, first of all, let me just be clear. I believe this is assets that are the life estates that are transferred into an irrevocable trust or an annuity. And so it's very specific. And one of the arguments against the life estates and joint tenancies in the past was, well, there are a lot of reasons to enter into those arrangements, and I agree with that for probate purposes and other purposes. And it's not all to shift assets away in order to become eligible for medical assistance. This is clearly a mechanism by which they're protecting that. We are opposed. I mean, we know that the probate section of the Bar Association is opposed to this provision. There's no middle ground that I can tell with regard to this. It's pretty clear. They fought us on the changes 2 years ago. They're fighting us on these issues too. It's just we're changing the way we do business. The whole intent here and globally is that with the choices that we've had to make in controlling our budget, and this also looks out for the future with the growth in our costs for long-term care costs, both for facilities and labor costs, that we need to make sure that people who have assets, people who have incomes, that would preclude them from being under programs use those assets and incomes to provide for their own care. And we are making a change in the way practices have been done in the state planning world. It happens all the time, and state planners always have to make their changes based on changes in tax code. This is one of the changes we're making in another area. And I just say that we need to do this. We need to have people take responsibility for their care. We also would like that when people go to their attorneys to figure out how they can pass on their assets to their kids, that either, I mean, there's still options. I mean, you can actually outright give the assets to the kids without retaining a life estate. The problem is most people want to retain that interest in the property so they can have that ownership thing. So it's an issue that that individuals have to deal with when they want to transfer assets. But that the easiest way to protect the assets and the advice from the attorneys will be by long-term care insurance or gift outright. And that's where we're heading. It's a long-term issue. We need to address this from a policy perspective long-term because of our aging population. As I mentioned yesterday, the cost drivers in our system and in our budget are the disabled population and waiver services and our elderly population and waiver services, and it's only going to get worse.
Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with any of most of what was just said. I think the suggestion that I've heard from them is that they may have some alternative ways to get at this that doesn't cause as many problems with some other trust law stuff. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll make sure that our folks check with them. Although I know the person who works specifically in this area is a member of that division, and I know he has regular conversation with them. So I'll make sure that those communications have taken place.
Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Goodenough. I understand what you're saying about going forward. My problem was and is going backwards and backdating a law, and that was in the cases of the life estate and joint tenancy, where they made a good faith effort to do the right things. Most of the people in my area, it's a way to pass on the family farm. And without any warning, so to speak, they were null and voided. And so that's, to me, a dangerous precedent to backdate a law, because that's basically what it did. We're seeing some pretty severe cases of people absolutely not even taking alternative care. 65% of our alternative care providers have lost that business because they...
Excuse me, Representative Tremba, is this to the issue of this? I mean, I don't want to go back to the liens on life estates. Did this proposal...
Mr. Chairman, I'm just asking, Commissioner, I understand what we're doing, and I know last year the numbers of savings weren't that high. Is there some middle ground where we can work some of this out? I'm serious about it. It's pretty serious stuff. And some of the annuitant things I know that we did probably 3 or 4 years ago have been overturned in other states and been found unconstitutional. And so have you looked at some of that, those kinds of consequences of this? And I don't know. I guess maybe all I'm asking is that maybe we can sit down and do some sort of a compromise for...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tremba, and Mr. Chair, if you allow me, just
briefly,
I could make this a long response.
Yeah.
I'll make it the brief response. The governor's proposal does not include purchasing or buying back any of that retroactivity. I understand the legislative process, and it's a long process, and our budget is the first step in that process, and that we know there's going to be negotiation that takes place. My primary concern with regard to the estate recovery issue and the sheltering of assets is that we make sure that as we move forward that we have some way to address what I consider this relatively easy way to shelter assets and allow people with assets to access our Medicaid system. And so I'm willing to work with you and other legislators to craft a compromise, but I think it's important that the basics of the philosophy that we're moving forward with stays in place.
Right.
And I might have overstated what, I mean, and I'm always willing to work on better alternatives to what we have in place and what we've done. There are reasons, and then I'll cut off, Mr. Chair, with alternative care. We allow people to place liens, and that was previous law and current law, on people who are in nursing homes and people who are eligible for medical assistance elderly waiver. Alternative care is the same program that elderly waiver is, except for two things. First of all, those are people that do not qualify for elderly waiver because either their assets are too high or their income is too high to qualify for the federal match program. In addition to that, it's 100% state money. So from my perspective, I know there's a talk about repealing all the liens on alternative care. I believe that leads to inequity because why would you allow liens to be placed against individuals who are at the lowest income levels on medical assistance and not place the same liens on and treat the same people the same way who have relatively higher incomes and higher asset levels on alternative care? So that, you know, whatever we do, I think we should treat those populations the same. And so with that,
And I'm sure there will continue to be, and I think that there is some room for negotiation here. Let's continue.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, on bottom of page 32, we begin the next priority area, and that is better managing our health care expenses. What we're proposing is the ability to implement a care management approach for those people who have a high risk for hospitalization. What happens is that we can develop a capability of identifying those people with that are high risk of hospitalization and provide care coordination to them. This is oftentimes done in the private market. This will also not only better manage our health care expenses, but also help people navigate through the health care system. It will provide a coordination service that allows people to even better access health care when necessary. Well, on bottom page 33 is another part of our proposal to better manage our health care expenses, and that is to put into place ability for us to identify what is effective health care and what is not effective health care. What we need to do is have the capacity to, through the development of evidence-based research, to identify what kind of health care works and to make sure that we cover health services that are very effective. This relates directly to some of the work that the health department did relating to evidence-based medicine. And what we need to do is have the same thing in health care as we have in the pharmacy area. We need a medical director. We need a medical policy council, just like we have a drug formulary committee in the drug area. And we need a capability of partnering with other states to identify health care sources that work and do not work and develop the evidence-based health plan for our clients. So this is asking you to give us the authority and the resources necessary to better manage our health care expenses going forward. This is an alternative, we believe, to other models of trying to cut off covered services, and we think that this is a more appropriate approach to providing effective health care to our clients.
Mr. Huntley?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Hosberg, how would you answer the statement that most of the evidence-based medicine is already assembled and, you know, that you can join the Cochrane group for $1,000 and that we already have systematic reviews that tell us what we ought to do, what the state of knowledge is? So why do we need, if those things are available, why do we need two more FTEs?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley, it's true that there is a repository like the Cochrane Institute and other evidence-based practice centers that have information, but not unique to our clients. Our clients have unique healthcare needs, socioeconomic as well as cultural needs and healthcare needs, especially around the health disparities issue. And so we're interested in working with other states to develop the capability of examining this from the perspective of our population. And also, it takes some work, certainly, to not only gain that knowledge about evidence-based medicine, but to actually apply it, to develop a benefit design for us, to put that into action, to implement that evidence-based, those guidelines and whatnot. And so that's what the Medical Policy Council will help us do, is that council intends to be also composed of health plan medical directors that we can then extend this beyond our fee-for-service arrangement and to also make sure that the health plans are carrying out and providing health care guidelines that are consistent with clinical evidence. So we need FTEs to implement this, not so much to do the research. Representative Huntley.
Well, just a statement, Mr. Chair. This item and the previous one are, I think, two areas that there's potential to make huge amounts of savings and improve the quality of care at the same time. I'm a little conflicted on this one as to whether this information is available and whether we need these two FTEs, but certainly both of these initiatives can save us huge amounts of money.
I appreciate your conservatism.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pumphrey, we'd be happy to follow up with you specifically on some of the research, but I do think that the bottom line is that the populations we serve do have different issues that we need to deal with, and that a lot of the studies that have been done aren't specific to the populations that we serve, and that's one of the issues, but we can get into more detail with that. I do want to make a note, because this comes up, is that this differs from some approaches other states have done, and the fact that what we're looking at is the healthcare services provided and have been proven to be effective for certain diagnoses. Now, arguably, things that we pay for, and people have asked us to say, well, identify the healthcare services that we won't pay for at all. And what we're finding is it's a lot more difficult than that, because there's healthcare services may be effective for certain types of diagnoses for certain types of people, but it may not be appropriate for other folks. And so this is, or certain other diagnoses. So this is the way to try to move through that and go through that system. Other states have set up, or one in particular has set up a system where even though service may be proven to be effective, they arbitrarily or they set a line that service isn't as important as another service, which some people refer to as rationing. That's not what this approach is. This approach is to identify the service and identify the service and its effectiveness with the diagnosis if it takes place based on evidence and scientific evidence that's out there. And so it is a different approach than what has been out there. And we know that people can easily mislead and bring this down to a different debate than where we're heading on it. But we want to engage in this debate because we do think, as Representative Huntley mentioned, that's very important in order for us to get a handle on our growing healthcare costs for the people that we serve.
I believe those two items are, I think, as this committee has reviewed before, the Baylor study work is what this came from. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, the third priority is program efficiency. In the bottom of page 34, we're talking about how we can improve the way we administer our programs. We administer them 89 different ways today, 87 counties and Minnesota Care Operations and the Mille Lacs Tribe. We have a very inconsistent process by which we administer this program. So what we want to do is not only apply our new eligibility system, Health Match, which will give us the ability to be more consistent, more efficient, and more accurate in determining eligibility. We also want to work with the counties to redesign how we administer these programs. This will give us the opportunity to do that. What we'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is bring back at some point later in the session a presentation to you as to how, what the design looks like. How will we administer these programs along with the counties more effectively, more efficiently? And we think that we can demonstrate to you that there's a need for us to completely redesign these programs. And so we'd like to provide that presentation to you later in the session, if that'd be okay.
Just a kind of a broad question, that is there pretty much agreement with the counties as these concepts have been discussed with the counties?
Mr. Chairman, we've had a business process redesign steering committee with the counties for some time. There's agreement certainly with where this is going and the need for us to change the way we administer the programs. So there's conceptual agreement. Now we need to get to the specifics as to exactly what role the county plays and what role the state plays. What do we centralize and what do we decentralize? And trying to get to make sure that we serve not only more efficient programs, but we also serve our clients more effectively.
Mr. Johnsberg, I'm reminded that some people are thinking about their stomachs for tonight because there's some restaurant that has something going on. Are you going to be able to get us done?
I'm not. I'm 2 minutes.
Excuse me. What's the problem?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Osberg, on page 7, I guess it is, of the spreadsheet there, the bright yellow pages, improve healthcare enrollment process. This is the only one of these things we're talking about so far today, I think, that is actually going to cost us money.
Mr. Chairman,
why is that?
But Representative Huntley, the reason that is because we need to invest in the state's ability to, in essence, assume the administrative and systems responsibility that the counties have today. We need a centralized approach to administering these programs around the system side and around the administrative side, allowing the counties to work more with the individuals and making sure their healthcare programs are thought through and the people are able to then make the right selection. So most of the return on this investment will be by the counties in terms of reduction of their requirements as to how to administer these programs. That allows them to spend more time in helping people to select the most appropriate program for them.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may add, Representative Huntley, Assistant Commissioner Osberg mentioned the provide for a more efficient way that we manage the eligibility process for these programs, but it also will improve customer service through the fact that this will be a centralized way to apply for the system, so there'll be less confusion and our error rates with regard to eligibility. We see that going down with regard to the whole thing. In addition to that, it will improve our program integrity. So there's a lot of things that this is part of. But when we look at providing more efficiency in the way we deliver our services, we're a state supervised or county administered program that we have to look at the county as well as the state and the way we deliver these services. So in this case, you'll see there may be a net cost to the state, but quite frankly, it'll free up responsibilities on the county level.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Goodnow, in terms of Minnesota Care, I've heard from various constituents that in addition to the 4 months they have to go without insurance, that it then takes 2.5 to 3 months to process the paperwork to get them.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, we're behind on those. We have reallocated, and we're putting on a new unit to try to catch up with those so we don't have that kind of backlog. We're aware of that problem. There's a combination of issues that came to play at the same time. We were expecting Health Match to be up and running more quickly than it's planned to be at this point. That's put some additional pressure on us as far as resources go. And then also the review of the applications every 6 months has basically served to double our caseload in the Minnesota Care program. And we didn't think we needed additional resources to deal with that additional caseload because of the Health Match system. Since it's not up and running, we're looking at that. So we're taking certain steps. We're first of all focusing on the people who are applying for the system to take care of that backlog, and so we can maintain that at a relatively quick turnaround. Number two, we do have a request to help us in a time period between now and when Health Match is up and running to make sure that we can comply with both the state and federal requirements with regard to the application process and the renewal process. And then we're also doing an internal process review to see if we can do it more efficiently so we can also address this without asking for additional resources.
Representative Goodman, we can be quick here as we're getting close on time. So,
well, Goodman. In fact, that's my comment. This is a big budget, and I would like more time to go through it with the department. Are we going to have more time than just today?
Representative Goodman, when we have the full bill, we'll be going through the bill, and we'll have department here available to answer questions, so we will spend lots more time.
Okay. I have a quick question for you then, Commissioner. The Health Match program is the one that we're outsourcing the work for. That's a $16 million program or somewhere thereabouts. My concern again is that as this contract proceeds, that we end up not having people in the department like we've had in the past that haven't been able to run the program appropriately, that we've become dependent on the consultants, that they've had basically lifelong jobs. And so how are you avoiding that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, when we went forward with the Health Match development and the contract with SSI, who has now been bought out by somebody else and changed their name, we set it up that the short-term expertise that we needed in order to develop the program, that was what we contracted with an outside vendor for. And that in the process, and what we included in the contract was their training of our staff, a retraining of some of our staff, to be able to do the long-term type of maintenance on the program and changes to the program in the future. So this is a temporary relationship with this company. It was built into the contract that there would be a transition away from reliance on them as the program is developed and reliance on our own employees to the extent when this is up and running that we will have our employees fully trained to be able to run this operation in the future. So we will not have that long-term commitment and long-term contract with this vendor.
Excellent. Thank you.
So, Kermit, did you?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just have a point of clarification. When people apply for Minnesota Care, we know about the backlog. Do you enroll them at the point of application or the point of process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tremba, what happens is that we enroll them the month after the premium is paid.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tremba.
So that means processed?
After the application's been processed and the premium's been paid, then they're enrolled in the health plan the month following that. First of the month following that.
Mr. Chair, it's Representative Wickstown, but just to give you an idea, with the new health match system, that's a web-based eligibility system, that the intent is that the person would get almost an immediate response with regard to a preliminary eligibility for the program that will get a formal notification, I believe, within a number of days after some further verification, so that the timeline will be streamlined. It will be consistent across the board, regardless of what program you apply for and where your access to the system is. So we're heading in the right direction. We have some problems right now that we have to deal with in the short term.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
can you give me an estimate of how long that's going to take so we know what to tell
us? Mr. Chairman, Representative Trumbo, the backlog is now 45 days, not 2 months or 2.5 months, but 45 days, and we expect that to be eliminated in the next probably month to 2 months. We're bringing on a staff of 23 people this month being trained, and so we intend to eliminate that backlog within the next month to 2 months.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, if we can pick it up.
Chairman, the last page, budget page, is page 37, and what this simply does is transfer the general assistance medical care program expenses over to the health care access fund. And the reason for that is because of the surplus in the health care access fund. We also believe that this is an appropriate place for this program to be financed, and because the access fund certainly is dedicated for healthcare programs. So there are some other changes we can get into, some revenue transfers we can get into, but in essence what this does is transfer the expenses associated with this program, including the expanded medical spend-down arrangement to be financed through the healthcare access fund.
Thank you. Representative Hutley?
Well, I know it's getting late, but the healthcare access fund was set up and paid for by the sick taxes in order to give working folks insurance. And if you put the GAMC people in there, especially with the new limits, they're not working people. So that what we will have done with this is indeed what the governor said, and that's turned Minnesota Care into a welfare program.
Well, Representative Huntley, we will have, and I don't want to say too much, but I think you know enough about what's happened in Minnesota Care and with the movement of people to both MA and GAMC that, frankly, what used to be isn't where we are anymore today. But we'll have plenty of chance to discuss this. Let's proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Wes Kleister was the next person. We have three items left, and he's convinced me that it's only going to take him 30 seconds.
Okay.
Or was it 8 minutes? I can't remember.
Welcome to me. Please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Wes Koistra. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services, and that includes state-operated services. My first page is on page 43. This is a request for operations costs for expanded forensic services. This committee should be familiar with this request, mm-hmm. because it was the basis of our deficiency request that we spent some length discussing earlier. This is a continuation of those costs. Our deficiency request was only for one-time money, so the money requested here continues that request. It annualizes the costs of units that were going to be put online towards the end of this year, and it adds a couple of units based upon the growth expectations going forward. So we're seeing about a growth of about 100 individuals this biennium. We expect growth to be about 25 a year after in the following biennium, and prior to this we were experiencing growth of about 50 to 18. So this is the same request with a continuation into the coming biennium and the biennium that follows. Page 45 includes four new areas of mental health coverage, primarily addressing issues of children's mental health. The first addition to the man-made benefit set would be treatment foster care. This is a professionalized foster care for children with severe emotional disturbances. It is a model that is being used by many counties right now without the benefit of MA payment. It provides training to the foster care parents. It provides training to the biological parents. Many of these children are placed in foster homes, not because there's any issues of neglect or abuse at their home. It's because the families can no longer have the resources to contend with a child with severe emotional disturbance. So this provides training to both the foster care and the biological parents, planning for reunification. It provides case management, psychotherapy, skills building, behavioral aids, and crisis services. The intent is for it to be a more professional level of treatment in the foster care setting with the goal of reunification. The next item is psychiatric case consultation. Currently, MA only allows for case consultation to occur between a primary care physician and a psychiatrist when the patient is present and through televideo. This allows that case consultation to occur when the patient is not present and through other means of communication, phone, fax, and as well as interactive video. Right now, because of our shortage of psychiatrists in this state, a lot of the psychiatric care is being provided through primary care physicians, and this is a huge benefit to have an opportunity to consult with psychiatrists as they're providing that care. The next item is interactive video, and this allows, again, this again addresses the shortage of psychiatry in our state, primarily in the rural areas, but also in the metro areas, and it allows psychiatry to be delivered through interactive video means and again be paid for through medical assistance. The final item on this page is assertive community treatment for youth in transition. We currently provide assertive community treatment for adults. This is a treatment team that includes case managers, treatment staff, behavioral staff, and goes to the person's home. This prevents hospitalization. It prevents more intense levels of care that are more costly, and we believe it can be of a good advantage to adolescents who are transitioning to adulthood. These children don't suddenly become adults. This is a critical period of their life, and we believe it's an important investment to prevent other more restrictive means of care.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cloister, what is the governor recommending for that program? What's the amount?
The amount of money?
Yes. Maybe I could find it.
Specifically to assertive community treatment for youth, the 07 costs are about $355,000, and it grows to about $1.5 million in 09.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
No, that's State Chair, Representative Goodwin. I'm sorry.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chrysler. Then, what is the current? Is there any current amount for that, or is that new?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, this is new.
Thank you. It's a good program. Thank you.
Thank you.
On page 40.
Representative Walker, excuse me. Quick one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just real quick with the key measures. Do you have further information as it relates on 46? Especially the very first one, the percentage of children reunified less than 12 months, knowing that there might be circumstances that keep them out. We have people on waiting lists to get services that don't match up necessarily initially, so that may prolong individuals completing their case plans and things of that nature and reunification. And so are things like that going to be taken into account when you're looking at the outcome-based measurement?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that they will, and I will follow up on that and get back to you. My last page that I'd like to cover is page 47, and this is expanded methamphetamine treatment capacity for women with children. This is part of the governor's broader proposal on addressing the issues of methamphetamine use. The other aspects of his proposal include prevention, which includes education and substance and controlling of the ingredients. It includes increased prosecution with investments in BCA agents and increasing penalties for manufacturers. It also includes cleanup. This is the treatment side of it. It's a small piece of a larger proposal. It's $300,000 a year, and we felt the best use of this because there is a greater prevalence of methamphetamine use among women than what you see in other drug use among women, that this we're going to apply these funds to provide the supports around treatment that include child care, housing subsidies, and so forth to try to create some stability in the family homes. This is used in a treatment context for some of the social service issues that come into play with parents with methamphetamine use.
Thank you. Mr. Questor and Commissioner, I really think that it would be wise for this committee to have a hearing on the whole issues of meth treatment. There's a great deal of controversy. I'm not really sure who's got the right answers, although I'm really impressed having recently visited with the Teen Challenge people. But the experts, all of us, seem to tell me that this is different. This is not like the standard, and maybe you can help us identify the right kind of folks to come to this committee and talk about treatment, particularly as it relates to people who are addicted to meth.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the key measures, the last point that you have on here, I'm interested in further information on how that is based. How do you know what is a positive outcome for a child? Words are great, but the specifics are better.
Mr. Questor?
Mr. Chair, we'll give you the specifics and share that with the rest of the committee.
Okay.
As well.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you. I know that there is a lot, but I have found over the years that, frankly, this is something that you don't learn in one pass. You kind of have multiple passes, so at least I think we've got a very good framework, and we will be revisiting some sections specifically. Tomorrow we will be reviewing the legislative audit report on the survey process for nursing homes, and we'll spend a little time also with the Department of Health on sort of their triage approach to handling incidents in nursing homes. I think that would kind of, if you want to be specific, would refer to the recent articles, I think, in one of the Twin Cities papers, so we'll have some discussion about that as well. There's no further discussions. We adjourn.